IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome to episode 41 of the Killing It Podcast. I'm Carl, and I'm joined today by Ryan. Dave is still on vacation for the new year. But Ryan, are you home?
I am home. I am on the ground. No airplane rides for this week, and actually enjoying it and being productive too. I'm actually getting stuff done on the holiday break.
I think I'm home till the 13th. So, but you know, I've got decent California weather. It's going to be 60 degrees and delightful here.
See, that does not actually hurt anybody's feelings. I was actually yesterday watching college football, as one does on the holiday break, and I watched the Rose Bowl broadcast, and it was a good football game. It was interesting from that point of view, but there was a point, and on the broadcast, the broadcasters were commenting about the sunset happening over Pasadena. It was spectacular. It was absolutely worth making a comment about. And I thought, oh, isn't that cute that the football broadcasters noticed this? I was on Twitter later in the evening. It was trending. It was actually this remarkable thing that everybody was like, wow, Southern California, they have really cool sunsets. I was like, welcome to the world. Everybody
exactly.
Probably visit Southern California just to see the sunsets.
Well, the good news is it's on the West Coast, so the sun actually sets in the West Zone.
Exactly.
I'm going to be in Santa Barbara in a couple weeks. So
nice. Yeah. One of my favorite towns in this whole wide world. You can go there and just sit.
Great beach. A little hard to get to. I've got a friend in the southern part of the LA community there. And I said, hey, I'm going to be in Santa Barbara. And she's like, yeah. That's no easier for me to get to than it is for you to get to.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I had an employee years ago on a field sales team who was based in the southern part of the LA basin. And I asked him one time to go and do a gig for me in Ventura. And he was like, you're not from here, are you?
I remember many years ago at a conference, telling somebody, oh, we're going to do this thing. It's going to be in Seattle. And he said, okay, great. Which airport do I fly into? And I'm like, yeah, you must be from Los Angeles.
Exactly. The airport.
Most places in the world, you just fly into the airport. So anyway, so this is episode 41, the first episode of 2020. Excellent. And we have some cool topics. And, you know, the first two of them, I'm sorry to say, are from California. So the first one is about our new privacy law, which technically goes into effect today, but it won't be enforced until July 1st. So everybody who's just now putting their attention on it in California, you got 6 months. So you want to tell us a little something about this?
Yeah. So the reason that I think this topic is so vital, in the very same sense that you and I are based in the United States, and yet we still need to be paying attention to GDPR regulations because we deal with companies who deal with customers on the other side of the world. You live in California, I live in Washington. Others around the other states will also be affected by this law, because it's not just if you are based as a business in California, it is customer privacy for data of residents of California. So, as a result, most of the industry and the significant players that are affected by this legislation are just approaching it with a national strategy. And fundamentally, what it says is, you as the provider must notify me when you are gathering information about me. You must tell me what kind of data you are capturing on me. You must tell me what kind of companies or third parties you will share that information with. Then, on request, at any point in time, I as the consumer can call you as the company and say, okay, give me a list of everybody you have ever shared my data with, or give me a list of all of the data points about me that you have captured and shared. Now, the intention of the law is to make it more responsible and to give you an opt-out, and it has a provision that prevents that company from penalizing you if you choose not to allow them to share your data. But I find that this is one hopeful step in the right direction of finally addressing this question of data sharing and privacy, because we know no matter how well-intentioned the business models around this have been, there have been some shenanigans that were utterly anticipated and completely unpreventable.
Right. So this isn't about break-ins. This isn't about Target having somebody break in and steal my data. This is about you selling a list, and I'm on the list.
Yep. And to the point of you as the provider now must provide a button on your homepage that says, allow me to opt out. And you have to make it that blatant and that easy for me to be able to say, you don't get to capture and share and profit off of my private data unless I'm okay with that, which in theory should promote some good community behavior between the provider and the consumer that says, I will be responsible with your data, and in return, you will allow me to profit.
So lots of things like fill my head. The first one is this remotely possible? Right? It's sort of like GDPR. I don't know if you filled out. I know you have. Like the 3/4 inch worth of paperwork that no one is going to read. It's like 3 insurance policies stacked on top of each other. No one is reading it. No one's doing it. They're just filling out forms and sticking them away somewhere.
Yes.
Until they get sued. Right?
As with all regulations, it's only real when it moves to enforcement.
Right. So, but the other thing is, obviously, if I'm collecting data so that I can ship something to you or even to invoice you, I've got your name, your mailing address, credit card information, right? Shipping address, probably phone number, email. I've got that data. So even if I don't put it on my mailing list and I don't sell it to somebody else, it's in my system somewhere. So that's not what's going on here. That's not what we have to worry about.
Yeah, that's not what's going on. This is not, I'm going to finally prevent hacking and the unintended disclosure of personally identifiable information. This is the open commercial relationship that says, I have data. You are a business that profits from collecting and sharing my data. Therefore, we're in this together and we need to treat each other with some respect. That, to my way of thinking, is the right way that we ought to be doing this together. The folks at Facebook have already made statements that disagree with the basic spirit of the law, in the sense that Mark Zuckerberg has been quoted as saying that in some roundabout way, what we do with your data shouldn't really be considered selling it, because it's really more providing it. We're not selling it. Therefore, we shouldn't be covered by the law. We know it's not a perfect solution. It's not going to be instantly fixing any of these problems. But it does create a new expectation that says, if you are going to profit off of my data, you need to tell me about that. And I need to be okay with the way that you treat that information.
It's so interesting. So my January 1st mailbox was filled with privacy notices. Some of them multiple times, you know, every email address I've ever had, from everything from my bank to my storefront to, you know, software I subscribe to and so forth and so on. I didn't read any of them, just to be honest. My assumption is everybody's selling everything. But the good news for IT providers, this probably doesn't apply to our listeners directly, maybe 4% of our listeners, because it applies to companies over $25 million in revenue.
Yep. Well, it applies.
But it does apply to our customers.
Exactly. It applies to any company that has more than $25 million in revenue or more than 50,000 users in their list, or if their business model derives more than 50% of revenue from data sharing. So in other words, if I am a social media network and I provide my service for free, and then I monetize that by aggregating and sharing the data, I would then be covered by this regulation. Not you as a solution provider, but your customers are probably going to be covered by this. And they need to know, what is the law? What does it mean? How does it apply? And what kind of administrative responsibilities are going to come from it? I would foresee that it's going to be confusing and complicated. And as a result, there's probably a tremendous opportunity for consulting services to explain this stuff to
you. Once again, one of our themes has become compliance is your friend, right? So if your clients fit any of those criteria and do business in the state of California, because you don't have to be a California business. There's a lot of confusion of that I've seen on Facebook where people go like, oh, they're based in Chicago. Yeah, don't care. You know,
do you have customers who reside in the state of California? Right. This is not a law about businesses in California. It is a law about the privacy of data for consumers in California. And I think that is going to affect all 50 states.
We've had for, I think, 5 years now, a requirement that if you're based in California, if you do business in California, you have to have your privacy policy and there's something else. Anyway, these things at the bottom of your website. So I've put them, I put up one page and then I own like 250 domains. They all point to that one page for my privacy policy, right?
Exactly. And that's probably radically more efficient than any of our listeners' customers' websites are set up. So,
but I assure you 97.8% of the people who do business in the state of California haven't complied with that law in the last 5 years.
Yeah, because there's not been any enforcement. This one seems to be public. And, oh, by the way, welcome to a United States election year. And the fact that that's going to be a big topic out there in the public discussion, I would predict that this year we're going to hear a lot about privacy and a lot about your ability to protect your information, whether that's data sharing or facial recognition or you name it. There's going to be a lot of talk about privacy in a digital world. Solution providers need to become experts about privacy in a digital world.
So do you want the greatest segue of the year so far?
Absolutely.
The next two topics deal specifically with these companies because it occurs to me a company like a Facebook or an Amazon can simply wave their hands and ignore this until they get sued, pay hundreds of million dollars in fines, and then decide that they're going to do something about it because of their approach to what you do in both the gig economy and as a unicorn. Boom.
Yes. Yes, I agree with that 100%. And I think that while the Googles of the world have that luxury, you as the channel businesses of the world do not have that luxury unless you all have way more money stashed away in your legal defense fund than we are.
Exactly. So topic number two is about the gig economy and another California law that goes into effect January 1st, 2020. And of course, no one knows how to deal with it. But basically, this law, AB 5 is what it was when it was a bill, says that under certain circumstances, if you are doing gig work, you must be an employee. And it's geared towards Uber and Lyft. But whether intentionally or not, it affects hairdressers, truck drivers, dog walkers, pizza delivery people, everybody who works in the gig economy and tries to make a few extra bucks on the side. The interesting thing to me is, and I have a political science background, I have no idea why someone would come up with this law. It basically says you can't have a contract relationship with another company. You have to be an employer and employee, and it just doesn't make any sense to me.
No, and in fact, I would argue that, you know, one of the things we've been tracking for years here in the channel business is growth and the opportunity to make a business more successful. Which companies are growing and thriving? What do they do differently from other competitors in the marketplace? What are the obstacles to growth? For the last, 11 years running, when we've been doing this research, the number one obstacle to growth for technology companies, whether you are a vendor or a solution provider, distributor, whichever layer you live at, number one obstacle to growth for each of the last 11 years running is the ability to find, hire, and retain quality individuals to fulfill your employee requirements. Now, I've spent a ton of time over the years talking about how to find and recruit good individuals and what's the difference between recruiting technical professionals versus sales professionals. The for all the best practices in the world, the one thing that I know for sure is that we will find a way around that difficult challenge. And the adaptation that has happened in our marketplace is that the vast majority of channel companies have a certain set of fixed employees that are on staff, W-2, they are professionally committed to the entity, and then another pool of contract, in the US terminology, 1099 contractors who perform service for us, but they're not full-time employees. That's not a casual thing that has been done by one or two companies. Hundreds of thousands of channel companies live in the reality of, I do, say I'm a managed service provider. I do remote monitoring and management of customer infrastructure and technology systems. Cool. But I might have an engineer who does that for me part-time or provides a special service overlay.
Or a programmer who works for me, works for you.
Exactly.
Dave's joining us for this topic as well. So welcome, sir. Welcome back from vacation.
Thank you. Calendar mix-ups today.
That's all right.
But that's the thing, right? That programming, that service that individual is providing, there's a three-part standard in the law, right? Then you guys will see this in the link that we're providing in the show notes. There's a three-part test that says you must be an employee unless you can prove all of the three things. One, that the worker is not controlled by the company. Two, that the worker performs work that is not central to that company's business. And three, that the worker has an independent business, right? So if I am incorporated and I am your CPA and you are a manufacturing firm, I provide a service that's necessary, but it's not central. I can be a contractor and not an employee. But if I am an MSP and you are a 1099 and you do programming work for me, that's absolutely central to
me. Now, I've had a lot of clients who are technology companies, and it might be dicey. All of this, to be honest, started, 15 years ago with Microsoft and Intel and all these other companies who were treating 1099s like employees, making them show up in a specific place, wear a specific uniform, do a specific job, and they controlled all of that. And so the feds have their own definition of what's a contractor versus an employee. But this law, I think, unexpectedly affects truck drivers and hairdressers and lots of other people.
Well, okay, so I'll dive in here and say, like, so you can't, we got to flirt with politics on this one a little bit, because the binary system of employment is broken. Like that is fundamentally the problem here, is that we're trying to say either it's this or that, and it doesn't allow for any level of gradient between that. You are either a full-time employee with all of the benefits, and I guess you can have a part-time employee, or you are not at all and don't get anything. There isn't, because because we link benefits to employment, you have to have this binary system. And unless we're willing to overhaul that, we have to look at other ways. And I think that, you can't have this conversation without it flirting with politics at some level to say.
So part of it is, I think we're in this era where the establishment, whatever that is pushing back against the gig economy. And I'm hoping, to be honest, that the state of California is going to lose all these lawsuits because I wouldn't want to see this go nationwide. There's a lot of people, and again, dog walkers, pizza deliverers, the Lyft driver, that they just want to get a little extra money on the side. This is not their 60-hour a week job.
Maybe. I don't know. I talk to a lot. I ride a lot of Ubers and I talk to a lot of guys that they're trying to make that their job. That's what they want their job to be.
There are some people that do that, but there's a whole lot of other people that don't.
Well, but, and there's also a whole layer of our society that is based on freelance, right? The entire media industry was built on the concept of stringers and freelance writers, people who were temporarily engaged but not permanently employed. I can write an article for you. I can write an article for you. And now what we're saying is, are you in the business of publishing articles that people write? Then central to the success of your business is the work of a freelancer. Therefore, that freelancer is now required to be an employee. I think, to Dave's point, this runs entirely contrary to the idea of the modern gig economy. And to, you know, borrow some of the thinking from Seth Godin on that topic, I think that's the way of the future. That we will not be, you know, we always joked with my parents, you know, it's like my, that generation, they had a job that lasted for their entire career and they worked for one company. And when I changed jobs three times in 6 years, my father was like, are you okay? Are you going to be okay? Is there something wrong in your world? We moved into a world in Gen X when, you know, moving from job to job became a normal thing. Okay, millennials and Gen Z are going to live in a world where not being a full-time employee, but doing work on projects for many different employers is going to be the normal way of the world. I think that's a very dynamic and good thing for us, and we don't need legislation that makes that harder. Now, I get the intention of this legislation because I do believe that the Uber guys are being evil with the way that they are manipulating the workforce.
I'll buy that.
Yeah, it's anti-worker, and in very many ways, they're doing it for very nefarious purposes. I get where the law came from. It's just...
Well, you bring up my other big concern in this space, which is I also look at the companies that are trying to abdicate their responsibility by using contractors. My favorite one I'm going to slam on, high social media companies that are outsourcing moderation to body shops. We laugh, but it's totally true. They are taking this difficult job of content moderation. They are outsourcing it using body shop style outsourcing, thinking you can do it in a call center, but additionally outsourcing some level of the liability and responsibility for that. And again, this comes down to, we have a binary system that allows employee or not. That's an area where I think that we need to be thinking about the implications of this, because it actually has real impact. If you're not reading some of the stuff that the Verge is doing around the reporting that in particular Casey Newton is doing around that outsourcing, the mental health impacts of that kind of work and the support that needs to be done there, they're leveraging that for protection and cost reduction at human expense. We've got to figure out a better way of having more options.
So is this simply 2020 is the year that the gradient view of employment emerges, where we say,
I think it has to be.
If somebody wants to work, see, here's the deal. They want to work 60 hours a week on Uber. Okay. They become an employee. Now they're limited to 40. Right. And then somebody else says, I want to earn an extra $10,000 this year in my spare time. Well, then they're not an employee. They're either a 1099 or whatever, there's got to be some other gradient. Is this the year that emerges?
Well, and that's the thing, because then those two different people come with different sets of overhead, fixed cost, administrative expense, tax liabilities, insurance coverage responsibilities. Therefore, the loaded cost of their service is not the same. And then Uber would have to charge differently for an employee versus a contractor. In order to make this transparent for the customer, I think we have to embrace the gradients of employment. And as small businesses, we need to live in a world where we are free to say, I can bring a team to a project to solve a customer's problem. And if all 10 people on this team are full-time employees, cool. But if only one of them is a full-time employee and the other 9 are freelancers brought together dynamically for the purpose of solving this one project, cool. Like, you can't tell me how to run my business. I need to be free.
Yeah.
Hey, so final word.
So your question is, is 2020? No, because we don't have the willpower to make it happen. I'm sorry. Like, I'm going to be the downer on this one and say, and this is my railing point is look, if you think this is a problem that needs to be solved, this is why we have to be having these conversations and getting involved as business leaders, because right now it's not getting solved. And I don't think there's the impetus to do it.
All righty. Thank you. Sorry to cut you off there, but we've got to get in the third topic. And this one is unicorns versus zebras. So unicorns, we all know, very big companies, privately held, over $1 million. They kind of have this startup view of the world. Ryan, you want to talk to us about what the Zebra Manifesto is?
Yeah, so I find this fascinating, and it goes back to a lot of the strategy work that we do with our clients. There are two kinds of companies in this world. There are companies that are designed and intended for scale, and then there are companies that are designed and intended for effectiveness, right? And if you think about the difference between these two companies, a unicorn is the successful representation of a startup that gets to a business use case that invests venture capital to accomplish drastic, radical scale, the hockey stick of new growth that then is built on a business model of an exit strategy via purchase or IPO, right? Like that's what everybody has defined as success. Well, except that everybody is a really inaccurate term there, because 99.9% of us live in the other kind of business. We're never going to have a hockey stick. That's not what we intend to accomplish. What we need to do is to solve a problem for a customer in a business model that is sustainable and profitable, and that while we can grow our business, we have no intention of taking on venture capital and hiring 10 times the number of people that work for us in the next 10 days.
So okay. It's fundamentally sustainable.
Exactly. Fundamentally sustainable as opposed to radically scalable. Two different kinds of companies in the world. This idea of the zebra manifesto, right? This came out a couple of years ago, and it's really been percolating, starting to gain some traction in the world. The idea is you should not feel bad for your intention to run a sustainable business. In fact, that should be...
What a novel idea.
Yes, and wow. We should reward those people and then provide resources for them.
So, this but it, part of it is that you're looking at saying, I want to be happy with a reasonable multiple. I want to be happy with a reasonable amount of income. I don't need all the money in the world, which, to be honest, all three of us have railed against the evils of some of these larger unicorn companies that all they want is the money and they don't actually care about the profit because they're using the money for other stuff.
Well, so, okay. So let me start. I almost have to preface any of my next comments by making the statement of I am a capitalist. I swear. Okay. I want to point out the realities of the market. And I mean the entire market. You know, the vast majority of businesses are small businesses. The vast majority of people are employed by those companies. But when we talk about the market half the time, we always mean Wall Street and stocks, and we mean investors. And that's not actually the market. I don't think we actually have really great ways of talking about the market sometimes in terms of the entire market. And I mean, I look at this and go, yeah, no S, you know, like build a basic business, right? Like that seems like a novel idea. Why are we celebrating that? Because we like these stories about people making a ton of money. It sounds really good, but I'm becoming more and more convinced that the pressures that that investors bring are not actually creating good outcomes, except for small groups of people, you know. And I think, and I want us to be more healthily skeptical. I'm not saying this is evil. I'm not saying they're doing anything wrong. I'm just saying we have to measure outcomes differently. Note, I'm not saying business outcomes necessarily, and I'm not necessarily saying purely profit.
And part
but I think
of it
we
is,
need to be skeptical.
There is an approach that these larger companies tend towards, which is that if you partner with them, you will find that they are bad partners. And my perfect example is always Amazon. As a buyer, I love Amazon. As an investor, I love Amazon. As a seller, as somebody who sells his products on Amazon, they are one of the worst partners you could ever have, because there is no limit to what they consider to be their share.
Right.
And if you create a product, and there's lots of people who have done it, you create a product from scratch, if it turns out to be really successful, they will go create an exact product and sell against you.
Well, so Carl, you were at this presentation because we did it down in Adelaide. So I've talked about it. I pulled it. If you haven't looked at it, look at the startup financing cycle on Wikipedia, because that's literally where I grabbed the graphic from. You can actually look at all kind of companies and find out where they are in their growth cycle and understand a lot about their motivation. it's my generalized experience that as companies move towards that large scale, that size, you know, that where they're looking for that large number, they actually become a lot less kind of interesting from most perspective, because they're actually getting to the point where they're saying, like, hey, we're all about revenue growth, not necessarily about, you know, creating new things or creating new opportunity. You know, I've been thinking about the, like, you know, we're all in the technology services space. As these guys get really big, as a generalized statement, what are they delivering that's adding more value to the chain? I'm not always certain of that.
Yeah, I'd see, and I agree with that. With that outcomes point of view, as well as the inputs point of view. If you look at that world of venture capital, we've been taught that that is the key to the kingdom that will make us all more successful. And yet, 30% of all new startups are founded by women, and yet women receive less than 3% of venture capital. Now, I think that there's a deeper reason behind that, but the ultimate takeaway is the businesses that get funded look almost exactly the same. That's not the answer for exploration, expansion, diversity, and growing a new foundation for an economy. We need to be able to celebrate the small local business who's been around for 15 years and he can adapt to the next change in the marketplace and continue to thrive. And that person needs to be the focus of the engine that we invest in.
All righty. Final word, Dave, and then we're done for the episode.
Yeah, you know, despite my coming in and railing, like, I actually am looking at 2020 as saying, I think there's a lot of opportunity here. I'm continuing to think that with as many of the interesting complex issues that we're talking about here, there is big opportunity for solution providers and technology providers that are thinking bigger and that are taking this stuff on. I'm not saying it's easy, but wow, I think there's opportunity here.
Yep. Well, the world is a very complicated place, and we'll be here to guide you through it in 2020. Thank you for listening to episode 41 of the Killing It podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.